Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Assisi, City of St. Francis, hosted last week's Day of Reflection, Dialogue and Prayer for Peace and Justice in the World. We hear from three church leaders of other Christian denominations present at that landmark meeting and from a group of young pilgrims putting ecumenism into practice at the grassroots. October 27th, 2011, the Umbrian hill town of Assisi, burial place of Saints Francis and Claire, once again became the setting for an international interfaith gathering of religious leaders pledging themselves to build bridges of dialogue, justice and peace within their own communities. 25 years after Pope John Paul II called the first such day of prayer for peace in Assisi, his successor, Benedict XVI, travelled up by train in the company of some 300 representatives of all the world's major faith traditions. Also present for the first time in such an event was a small delegation of non-believers, people of no particular faith, but who share the same vision of peace-building as an urgent priority in today's world. During a morning celebration in the Basilica of St. Mary of the Angels, the Pope was joined by leaders of the Protestant, Orthodox, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh and native religious communities to share their ideas and aspirations. In the afternoon, all the faith leaders once again met in the square outside the Basilica of St. Francis to condemn violence and to recommit themselves to being instruments of peace in the world. At the end of the intense one-day encounter, Pope Benedict stressed the spiritual dimension as an essential part of this ambitious task.
Today's event is an image of how the spiritual dimension is a key element in the building of peace. So this unique pilgrimage, we have been able to engage in fraternal dialogue, to deepen our friendship, and to come together in silence and prayer. After renewing our commitment to peace, and exchanging with one another a sign of peace, we feel even more profoundly involved, together with all the men and women from the communities that we represent, in our common human journey.
Pope Benedict speaking at the Day of Reflection, Dialogue and Prayer for Justice and Peace in Assisi. Among those taking part in that historic meeting were the President and General Secretary of the Lutheran World Federation, Bishop Munib Yunan from Jerusalem and Reverend Martin Junge from Germany. You're attending this meeting 25 years on from the original Assisi meeting called for by Pope John Paul II. First of all, what do you think is the purpose, the goals of a meeting like this?
Well, first of all, I think it's very essential that religious people meet together, because I think even if we are celebrating today the 25th anniversary of Assisi, we are noticing that the world is much more divided and the world is on the verge of, you know, more extremism, more misunderstanding among nations, and we are noticing that justice has not come. And I believe the purpose of that is to revive, you know, our commitment that religion must not be a source of a conflict, but religion must be the source of finding the common values for justice, peace, reconciliation and coexistence, or I would say it in this way, peace based on justice. And at the same time, reconciliation based on forgiveness. For me, if we look at the Middle East at the moment, I think the Middle East needs at the moment justice. And if we look, you know, at Latin America, it needs justice. Africa, justice. If justice is not solved and is not given, we will continue to witness even more, you know, more wars, more misunderstandings, more extremism, more conflicts, and the world does not need the wars. We need, you know, to make peace based on justice in order to eradicate all injustice and oppression in the world, including poverty, because also poverty is the result of injustice.
Many of the religious leaders speaking in the Basilica talked of the Middle East, Jerusalem in particular, and the great need to find peace in Jerusalem. But how can a meeting of this kind in any practical way help to promote that peace that you so work for within all the different religious communities?
I think, you know, Jerusalem is the mother of every nation and every human being. And the Jerusalem must be also the mother of justice and peace. And at least we should really commit ourselves at this time that to work for the peace of Jerusalem, and from, you know, the speech of the World Council of Churches and others, it was very clear that Jerusalem cannot be exclusive. Jerusalem must be shared. It must be for the three religions and the two nations, because there will won't be peace in the Middle East, or if you like, in the world, if there isn't peace in Jerusalem and justice in Jerusalem.
At the same time, when I came here, I was reflecting on the fact that some few weeks ago, the Nobel Prize was given to three women, which based on their faith have been leading processes of resisting violence, overcoming violence and building peace. So we shouldn't see what we are doing here as leaders of worldwide religious communities in isolation of what people on the ground, motivated by faith, are doing in order to overcome violence and conflict and be a constructive presence. So if we see the two together, there is a lot of potential of what we can do.
Interestingly, the only woman speaking in the Basilica was a non-believer, one of the representatives from the delegation of non-believers. Do you think the role of women is still being underestimated, particularly the role they can play as peacemakers? Do you think this role is being underestimated within the Christian churches today still?
I think, again, I was so grateful for that Nobel Prize because it recognized the role of women and it recognized the role of women in their capacity as full citizens in their own right, on their own right, and contributing to peace. I think we as LWF, as Lutheran World Federation, we have seen and we recognize the gifts of women both as a gift, but also as a task for the church to learn to incorporate those gifts in a much better way in order to give them expression. For us, the question of women in leadership positions is a question which we are working on. So I would indeed say yes. I think women have a lot to contribute. They do contribute a lot. And I'm sure if you look at the process in Liberia, the way it was led, I would be really interested, if you allow me these words here, to have a gender analysis of how this was done.
Interesting. What will you be taking back with you after this event? It's an event where so many different faiths, so many different denominations are present. What will you be taking back to your own communities with you and working with over the coming months?
Well, it's good, I think, when we go back, especially when we go back to areas where there are conflicts and when there are, you know, wars, then to know that to build peace and to build justice, you cannot do it alone. You can do it only in a communion. And this is the reason, I think, in the Lutheran World Federation, we are a communion of churches. And we are a communion that is committed for justice everywhere. I think if we can revive it in our Lutheran World Federation, if we can really, in our interfaith dialogue with other religions, we can also insist on the commitment for working for justice and peace, and also, you know, with the ecumenical movement, with the Vatican, with World Council churches, with the evangelical churches, with we have really to every now and then, you know, revive the commitment of what we are doing, because I think, you know, it's very essential to know that politicians always are expecting to hear the prophetic voice of the church. And we as Lutherans are, and the Lutheran Federation are committed that our voice will be wrong, whatever is the price. You see, we are committed for that. You see, and we hope others will commit themselves with us.
I think for me, first of all, I was grateful actually for having the opportunity after 25 years to come together. And reflecting as I came here, I thought also, yes, maybe those struggles, they take 25 years and more. So, and it is good if religious leaders, they come together and they recommit to what has been said in the past, and they want to continue working on it. So I think in a time of short-term thinking, to have that long-term perspective and to have also the strength to hold on processes and values in the long-term perspective is something I take back. I take back also something which I heard this time. I was not part of the 86. I was a student there at those times. But reading a bit through those materials, I saw many speakers not only insisting on the common values and things, but also very boldly speaking about our distinctiveness, the otherness of the other. And I see there a new impulse here. This is not an issue of like-mindedness. This is not an issue of uniformity. This is an issue of getting to learn and to respect the other. And I think this is a new impulse. So I would say, for me at least, this has not been just a commemoration. This has not been just a repetition. I take back some reflections which I would want to bring into the life of the Lutheran World Federation as impulses, so that, as Bishop Munib Yunan has said, so that we can indeed be prophets of peace building and not in the forefront of conflict and violence.
Lovely, thank you very much.
And of course we hope that after 25 years, when we celebrate 50 years, the Middle East will be living in justice and peace. There will be no poverty in the world. People will have no financial recession. People will be living really. The prophecy of Isaiah and Micah will be a reality. And I think this is what we are all committed as Christians.
Amen. Inshallah. Thanks there to Bishop Munib Yunan from Jerusalem and Reverend Martin Junger from Germany, the President and General Secretary of the World Lutheran Federation. Another of the key speakers at the historic Assisi gathering was the General Secretary of the World Council of Churches, Norwegian pastor Dr. Olav Fuxi Tveit.
It is quite significant that we have this manifestation of how religious leaders around the world, all kinds of faiths and also communities not claiming to have a faith, are willing to commit themselves to peace as a priority. I think we have to do this again and again, because there are always new challenges that need our commitment, that need our focus. And as I said in my address here, I think, for example, we now need to focus on how we bring young people into focus, both their contribution but also their needs for work, for a future, for hope, but also to take their contribution and their values into the work of peace.
You said that young people have not been properly appreciated within the churches, the Christian churches in particular.
Well, I said that I don't think we have done enough to give them a proper place. I think also we see in many ways when young people get both the opportunity but also get some space for their involvement for peace, they both are creative and also quite able to take new initiatives. Some of these movements who are here, who are not that young anymore, like the Focolare movement and the San Egidio movement and others, and also the Tese movement, are movements of peace for young people. And we see, fortunately, they recruit young people for a spirituality of peace. And I wanted to also to acknowledge that through what I said.
You also spoke about the central role of Jerusalem, the importance of finding peace in Jerusalem, didn't you, as a crucial part of the puzzle as we looked how religions can work together better.
Yes, I spoke about Jerusalem as a challenge for all of us and a responsibility, particularly for the three Abrahamic religions, Jews and the Christians and the Muslims. As this is a holy city for all three of us have to consider how we give some space for the other, none of us can have the whole.
And how we can influence, though, the political leaders, how religious leaders can be more concrete in their bringing their contribution to the political peace process.
I think there is an important process going on among the religious leaders in Jerusalem itself. I know that this Council of Religious Leaders there are doing quite a lot of important studies and also try to take some initiatives when there is a need for it and when there is some openness for it. I think they need the attention of the global church fellowship, which I can speak for, so that there is a strong support, a positive attention, but also a positive expectation to what we can offer both them and those who live around Jerusalem and in Jerusalem, all these peoples, the Jews, the Palestinians and others, and bring a modus of peace, an expectation of peace as a basic element of life in Jerusalem and not conflict. If I may, I would also add just one word about the young people. I was very impressed by how the young people of my own people in Norway were able to both to express their commitment to peace even when they were attacked in this horrible terror attack in July this year. And knowing personally at least one of them who survived, who's a student living in our house in Norway, how she dedicated her scars to be scars of hope, of unity and of fellowship, because her friends put stones on her wounds and made her survive, as expressions of cruelties. The terror shall not be to have the last word. It should not destroy our future. And this power of being willing to look forward and also being able to look forward and look into another future, it's exactly what I'm talking about when I think we need also the strength of the young people here.
This is an incredibly powerful testimony, an incredibly powerful story of someone who refused to give in to natural feelings of revenge and hatred for what had happened. What do you think is it within a person that enables them to bring out that side, that sense of goodness?
Well, I think there are at least two dimensions. One is that they have been part of a fellowship, in this case a political fellowship, which have certain values of how they want to shape the future as a future for everybody, where with equal rights, with equal opportunities, and therefore will not accept that this will destroy their aspirations. But I think also that this is a sign of how strong real friendship can be. And as far as I can understand, this was a very strong experience of friendship among them and how friendship could save them. And I think that is also a gift from God, which we also, as religious communities, really should also know how to value. We should remember that Jesus Christ called his disciples friends, and that is the highest dignity he could give them.
How is Norway recovering from that terrible attack, as you say, such an unexpected thing?
I think the way the leadership of the nation, the government, the king and the crown prince and others, and also the church leadership and other religious leaders, also the Muslims, they reacted in a way that helped the whole population to mourn, to stand together, to embrace one another, and to not let all the bad feelings steer the whole reaction. Now is the time to try to come back to normal life, and that's difficult. I now understand that there are critical discussions, there are critical questions about why, how could it happen and all this. And I think they have to go through this, and I think the way also the nation will be led through this will show that it is possible and that the church appear again for the people as a room, as a space, for expressing your deepest feeling in prayers and in mourning, but also an institution that offer you a positive approach, saying this is not the last word, there is also hope. Don't let your hearts be afraid. That was the message of the presiding bishop the first Sunday. I think that is remaining in their hearts.
And the message of Pope John Paul II, of course, this do not be afraid. How much do you think his legacy is present here in Assisi at this meeting?
Well, I feel it very strongly. Also when I hear what is said here, but also when I see how it is so natural for religious people to come together like this. It was not at all natural 25 years ago. It should really emphasize the importance of prophetic initiatives. And I think that was exactly what he did, and we all benefit from it.
Looking back, of course, to the figure of St. Francis, which so many people did in the Basilica, a man with that passion and daring for peace. What does St. Francis mean, perhaps within the Protestant traditions, within the northern world, if you like?
Maybe he's one of the saints that really has a very strong place in Protestant churches and in Protestant catechism. For example, we all learn a prayer which is dedicated to his name, a prayer for peace. We all learn about how he was able to transform his whole understanding of the values of life as a young man, dedicating his life to be with the poor people, to be in solidarity with them and not take advantage of his benefit as a privileged person. And I think this has a strong appeal to all people, and particularly I think it appeals also to us as Protestants, but in our upbringing we also learn how to be grateful for creation, how to be stewards of creation. And his example is a great inspiration also, particularly in these days, as we all have to address our responsibility for preserving the creation in which we live.
My thanks there to Reverend Olaf Fixe Tveit, the General Secretary of the World Council of Churches. It wasn't just the leaders of the world's faith communities that had gathered in Assisi. Also present were many ordinary pilgrims who had come to take part in that historic event. Among them, a group from the Anglican Diocese of St Albans in England, who, as I discovered, had been putting ecumenism into practice in a very practical way.
My name's Father Darren Collins. I'm a priest from the Diocese of St Albans in England.
And I'm Canon Richard Watson, the sub-dean of St Albans Cathedral.
My name's Tim Vickers and I'm a young person from the Diocese of St Albans.
And I'm Lauren Croucher, one of the bishop's nominees on synod for the Diocese of St Albans.
And you're here in Assisi, but you've come a long way to reach this destination, haven't you?
We have. We journeyed over here last Wednesday and we went to Loreto and we met up with our friends from the Orthodox Church in Romania and the Catholic Church in Italy. And we've had a 7-day walking pilgrimage to make our way across to Assisi to, as a walk of peace and unity, to come together today to meet with Archbishop and also the Pope.
So what does it feel like to be here in Assisi? What are your expectations ahead of this meeting?
I think our expectations have changed during the week, because initially you come joining up with your friends and thinking, oh, we can't wait to get to the last day. But actually, as you're journeying through the week, you're becoming closer in friends, in worship, and then coming today as a joint church between the Orthodox, the Catholics and the Anglicans is just fabulous. And to see our leaders up the front together asking for peace in the world is just a wonderful experience, and we hope it may change the world.
What do you think have been the most powerful moments perhaps during this week of pilgrimage?
I think probably the quieter times. We've had all weathers. We started off with grey skies and that was quite cool and manageable. We had a couple of days of quite warm sunshine, and then the last 2 days as we hit Assisi have been torrential rain. So we've sung as we've walked, we've talked, but also we've just fallen silent and just been with each other in company. And I think that says a lot about our ecumenical relationships, that sometimes there's something to talk about, other times there's just the chance to be still together. So it's been incredibly profound as a group of friends travelling.
How about for you two, the lay people? How do you see this journey? What has it meant for you? What have perhaps have been the most significant moments?
I think it's really a journey of discovery. We don't get any opportunity to actually just be with people of other denominations, other traditions in the church, finding out about how they feel about Anglicanism, how we, you know, worshipping together, just being together. We don't get that opportunity very often, really, and just being able to do that on a journey together to the same destination is really sort of symbolic of our, we're all on the same path to the same place, and that's what I really feel about it.
And you?
I've been doing this trip now for 3 years, and each year it gets better. We build better relationships, it brings us all closer together, and to walk from Loreto to Assisi is kind of like the icing on top of the cake. We've all come together, we've all started and we've all finished. And it's just been like a magical week, really.
How many of you in the group?
There's 5 English people, Anglicans. There's 6 Orthodox and there's 4 Catholics
from Italy.
St Albans is particularly renowned, isn't it, for its ecumenical leadership, perhaps, yeah, even, it's fair to say, in the UK.
I think it was the Dean Moore at St Albans Cathedral was one of the first to set an ecumenical chaplaincy up within the cathedral, and he appointed the first Catholic lay canon of the cathedral, which is very important. And within the cathedral itself, there are different ecumenical services throughout the week, whether it's a Roman Catholic Mass on a Friday or whether it's the Free Church coming in and other traditions who wish to use it. So the diocese and the cathedral see themselves as an ecumenical centre. And I think a lot of that was when Robert Runtze, the ex-Archbishop of Canterbury, was there as the bishop as well, who encouraged it. And also 25 years ago at the meeting here, he was there.
This is the grassroots speaking, extraordinarily good ecumenical relations. As you know, at the top level, people talk about the ecumenical winter. What's your reaction to that?
I think winter is always a time of growth, but the growth is often unseen. So what appears to be a winter on the outside, there's lots germinating underneath. And I think it is at grassroots that anything happens, really. And then the growth reaches upwards. So, we've been a group of young people, some of us not so young, but in the privileged company of younger people. And who knows which of those are going to be our church leaders in 10, 15, 20 years' time. And the experience that they're having at the grassroots now will change the church in the future, without a doubt.
This is the culmination, because we've been journeying together, for, as Lauren said, for 3 years, and we meet up for a week every August in Loreto to journey together, worship together, and try and forge closer links and understandings of our different traditions. And that's been key, and today is bringing together those 3 years. And it's been different young people through those 3 years have taken the message of ecumenism back to their countries. And some of the countries, there's not an ecumenical talks at all. But now they're starting to understand it more.
Yes, I can imagine. From the Orthodox world, for example, what kind of lessons perhaps have you learned from that, from the Eastern Christianity, if you like, the other lung, as Pope John Paul used to call it?
Yeah, it was probably the line that, coming from England, that we knew the least, because we mix with our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters all the time. But the Orthodox, we have very limited contact. I mean, it was quite of a scary thing, first of all. But worshipping with them, talking with them, and they're telling us about their journey since the 11th century. You come to understand, actually, they're not so different. We create a mindset that they're totally opposite, but really, they're not. Their Eucharist is very inclusive for everyone. Every single person within the Orthodox tradition can receive on a Sunday. They bless the bread halfway through, and everyone can receive, but then it's taken to the altar and then consecrated. So those who have been, who have received confession and have fasted the day before can receive on the Sunday. But the rest receive the blessed bread. It's a sign that everyone is a part of the meal. And I think for the ecumenical movement as well, everyone should be a part of the meal together, which perhaps sometimes the Anglican or the Roman Catholic Eucharist isn't. So,
how do you mean it's more inclusive, perhaps, than ours?
Because every single person within the Orthodox tradition can receive on a Sunday. Only they bless the bread halfway through, and everyone can receive, but then it's taken to the altar and then consecrated. So those who have been, who have received confession and have fasted the day before can receive on the Sunday, but the rest receive the blessed bread. It's a sign that everyone is a part of the meal. And I think for the ecumenical movement as well, everyone should be a part of the meal together.
My thanks there to Father Darren Collins, Canon Richard Watson, Lauren Croucher and Tim Vickers from the Anglican Diocese of St Albans in England. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.